Okay, well, I'd like to welcome everyone here at the ADITA Conference, Interfaith 2005, here in Edmonton, and I'm, of course, Steve Downs. Normally, I capture the introduction, but I had my pictures running of the sideways churches, so if you're wondering, the first set of pictures was from last week in North Bay, when I went walking through the woods, and then the second set was in Guelph. Well, that's a pretty low-key start, isn't it? But now I'm all set. I hardly ever give the same talk twice, and I'm not going to give the same talk twice, but those of you who follow my website will notice that this has the same title as the talk that I gave at the CIDR online symposium, except I've added the words Alberta Cut to it just to distinguish it. So I was thinking this morning as I added those words, I guess it's a little bit juicier, a little bit richer than the previous version of the talk, which was also to Alberta, because of course it was to Athabasca University. I wanted to reprise this talk a bit because, Bill was saying RSS will be new to people. I want to test that actually. How many of you have heard of RSS? Okay, more than half. That's pretty good.
I'll be a buck.
Yeah, you owe me a buck. But also because I'm not going to be able to give this kind of talk for 6 months or so. And so I wanted to come back at it, try to come up with a more definitive statement of it, or at the very least a second statement of it. And I think it'll still be useful and interesting. Just curious, how many of you have seen the previous slides or listened to the recording of my previous talk? One. You can go. Oh, and I'm getting ICQ sound effects. I really should turn off things like Skype and ICQ and stuff before I do a talk, but I always forget. And actually, it messes up my recording sometimes, so I'm just going to zip out of here and make sure I'm still recording. Yeah, we're still going. Okay. Basically, what this talk is about is a shift that's taking place in e-learning. I prefer to call it online learning. Everybody's been calling it e-learning these days, which even the name of my group at NRC is the e-learning research group. So I'm in a group, the name of which I really fundamentally disagree with. So when I say e-learning, I mean online learning. I don't mean CD-ROMs and all of that kind of stuff. I mean learning supported using the internet. And what I'm observing, and I wasn't lying to Bill when I said, you know, things change in the last minute. I've seen this even the last few days. There have been some new resources, some new arguments, some new things introduced, and I've added them to these slides. I'm seeing a shift in what I've come to call traditional e-learning, and this will be the type of online learning that you're all involved with for the most part, involving things like learning management systems, WebCT, online courses, online classes, things like that, to a new type of e-learning. And as I'll mention in the slides later on, there's a thing out there being called Web 2.0. And I'll talk about that briefly. And what this is the e-learning version of Web 2.0. Now, of course, e-learning 2.0 has been in development for a long time, well before all this stuff about Web 2.0 came along, but so has Web 2.0, so it doesn't really matter. In a sense, it's just a name, but in a sense, it signifies something rather more. And it signifies what to me is a fairly fundamental shift in our orientation, our attitude toward learning. So I'm going to start off with a little bit about trends. I'm going to zip through this because a lot of this stuff will be review. Then I'm going to talk more specifically about the nature and structure of what I'm calling here e-learning 2.0. Then I'm going to wave my arms a little bit and talk about where this is going to go in the future. find my mouse. Oops, sorry. Hey, you've all been reading this slide while I've been talking. Oh, God, I thought she was leaving, but she's just changing seats. You know, you do the introduction and people start to leave the room. You think, oh, geez, wrong talk. You've heard this stuff about the millennials, right? How many have? Most of you? Yeah. Basically, it's the generation of students now arriving at our doorsteps that have grown up in a technological environment, have grown up thinking that Pong is history, have grown up, there has always been computers, there has always been Google. And there are some features of this generation that have been captured by various demographers. I saw another one in North Bay, in fact, saying pretty much the same thing, where they assume the technology will always be available, where they, in fact, assume there will be multiple points of technology and they will use them all at once. Hence, you see people watching TV, chatting on the phone, doing their homework, and maybe even reading, where they expect instant and rapid response. If there's a delay, a turnaround time of more than a few minutes to an email, they sort of wonder, are they sick? And most importantly, for the purposes of my talk, they find institutions not wrong, not evil, but for the most part irrelevant. This has been captured by some of the demographers. I remember that big report in the Globe and Mail, I guess it was a year or so ago, talking about the new generation, and one of the things that was very worrying about the new generation is that they don't vote, for the most part. It's not because they're cynical, well, it is, but mostly, and it's not because they're not involved in community life. It turns out they're very involved, but it's because they find the traditional institutions and the traditional trappings of democracy, for the most part, to be irrelevant. And I will point out that this is not an age thing. Now, you know, there is a demographic cluster toward the young, but I consider myself to be well inside that. You know, I'm obviously not a millennial because I wouldn't be allowed to speak, but I find myself well within in that cluster. The people I saw at North Bay talking, they talked about Gen X and Gen Y. You know, so you have the baby boomers, and then Gen X, and then Gen Y. Whoops. And Gen X is sort of like Gen Y light, where, you know, so, you know, assume technology, Gen X is, or, well, it should be here, and Gen Y is, where is it? And they always put me in the baby boomers. I was born in 1959, and I've always resisted that, because I am not a baby boomer. I'm much more closely affiliated with Gen X, which means, yes, I'm a slacker, but it also, it accounts for Bill saying, you know, I forget what you said, controversial things? To me, they're not controversial. And I'm always amazed when people say, he says controversial things. It is not controversial to say that, to me, to say that the institution is irrelevant. It is not controversial to me to say that there need not be an intermediary between the source and the receiver of a transmission of some sort of information. I read once a long time ago that I actually belong to a little thing called the Jones Generation. Jones, because nobody's really heard of it. Everyone's heard of it, but nobody's heard of it. There's a little slice of people in between the baby boomers and Gen X, captured, I will say, brilliantly by that show, That 70s Show. That's who I am. Hyde. This is how he turns out, folks. Yeah. And this has been recognized. I said I was going to zip through this, and now I'm lingering on it. But I think it's important, because yesterday, I've forgotten his name, Milliron? I've forgotten his first name, too. He's talking about, you know, people don't even see what they're not looking for. And this is quite literally true, and I've had plenty of evidence for this. And so it's worth taking the time to kind of set this out. There's Lakoff talks about frames. I'm trying to set a frame here. I'm trying to reorient the thinking so that when I do come and talk tech, it's not this weird little mystery. The tech fits into this frame. The tech fits into this attitude, this way of looking at the world. And some people have captured it. Clue Train Manifesto, David Weinberger and others. How many of you have seen the Clue Train Manifesto? All right. Assignment number one, you will be tested. The link is there underneath the picture. These slides, by the way, will all be available on my website. If I have internet access, then at the conclusion of this presentation, as will the audio, assuming the recording continues. This is my third talk on one battery, so I'm pushing it. Go to the Clue Train Manifesto. Read the Clue Train Manifesto. Very important. The concept here, the Clue Train Manifesto begins with the sentence, markets are conversations. That's a little bit misleading. But what the sense here is that the traditional distinction between producer and consumer is breaking down. And it's breaking down in education, it's breaking down in industry, it's really breaking down these days in media. And what that means, what that entails is that traditionally you had the situation where you have a producer or a broadcaster or a teacher, and you'd have a consumer or a viewer or a student. And the producer would produce and the student would consume. And it all went one way. That doesn't happen anymore. Rather, the consumer or the viewer or the student expects to be not simply engaged in a conversation, not like, you know, some kind of webbed version of letters to the editor, but actually intimately involved in the creation process right from the very beginning. Manufacturing a pair of pants. The consumer expects to be making decisions about the material, making decisions about the cut. This is before... You didn't think I was really going to hit that coffee, did you?
I wanted to remove all distractions.
What they've done here is they put the usability. I talk about usability. Nice podium here. The top of the table here is sloped. And so I'm looking around, I have my coffee, looking around for the one flat surface. I find it. This is not a coffee table, it says in big black print. Now, in the Clue Train world, I, as the speaker, would have designed this podium before I came here. Now, how do you pull that off? Oh, that's when you start talking, you know, tech and widgets and web services and all of that stuff, right? But the idea here is that I wouldn't just be passively consuming my environment. I'd be shaping my environment. And so this divide between producer and consumer collapses. And it's not simply a communications collapse, it's a power collapse, where it's not the case anymore that we decide, you read. That's the brilliance of Fox's news slogan, right? We report, you decide. But the people are turning that around. It's like, we report, you can, whatever. Forget about the deciding bit. We don't need the deciding bit anymore. We disintermediated it. We don't need the reporter bit anymore. We can do that ourselves. I'll talk about that. In our field, a lot of this is coming in under the heading of learner-centered design. I'm not going to say learner-centered design properly so-called, because if you go, you read the articles in the journal, in the journals and things like that, learner-centered design really means, you know, you get to push a button every once in a while or things like that. So you're still kind of a passive consumer. But full-fledged learning, learner-centered design really is radical when you think of the point of view of the institutes in which most of you work, where learners make their own choices, not only about how to learn, not only about learning styles, but even about what to learn. And this occurs not simply in the post-secondary education, but it gets pushed down as far into the K-12 sector as possible. Active learning is just the learn-speak way of talking about the breaking down of this mediation between producer and consumer. I'll come back to that. The idea of teaching and learning not as, well, not what we're doing here, where you could put some guy up at the podium and he broadcasts, but more like what I do in my newsletter, where I'm one of hundreds of people, quite literally hundreds of people, putting stuff out about online learning, and the people who are supposedly my students are in fact themselves doing the same thing that I'm doing, and it's an interaction, it's an interplay. If you look at my website is intended to be an instantiation of where I think learning, indeed even formal learning, college learning, university learning, is going to go in the future. And if I put myself in the position of a university professor, and we pretend for a moment that I am, and if I put myself in the position where all the readers are students, then my presentation on my website would be how I would want to approach that. So the students are out there, they subscribe, they unsubscribe, they really unsubscribe. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, they come, they go. If you're reading the newsletter, you look at the articles, some of them you like, you read those, some of them you don't want to read, that's fine, you skip over it. Some days you miss, who cares? There's no test, there's no exam. And a lot of people, not everybody, but those who are devoted students of this, they engage in some way. They create their own blog, their own newsletter, they leave comments, they write their own articles. And it's not a broadcast receive, but it's an interaction kind of process. George Siemens has given this a nice name, connectivism. Kind of a neat name because it blends a philosophical and computational term, connectionism, with an educational term, constructivism. And it creates connectivism, and we looked out in Google to see if it was there, and it wasn't there anywhere, so we thought, great. I since have found that it is out there somewhere, just didn't find it the first time. The idea here, and do read, this is your second assignment, read this paper, read it after ClueTrain. You need ClueTrain first, because otherwise none of this will make sense. But the idea here is that knowledge no longer resides in some expert standing in the front of the room. I do a lot of these talks, right? Again, those of you who look at my website, you'll know that like this is my fifth or sixth talk in 2 weeks. I'm about to do like this. But every time I do one of these talks, I walk into the room, I look up at all of you, and I know that there is a lot more knowledge in that audience than there is at this podium. And even person for person, you know a lot more about lots of things than I do. And that's the new reality. Nobody can know it all. Nobody can know it all, even in their own domain of specialization. I specialize in this stuff. I've devoted years and years to this stuff. And yet, every time I come into a conference or something like, someone's got something new to tell me. New technology, new theory, new authors, real famous person. I've never heard of them. That's the new reality. Knowledge is distributed. I sometimes use the example, who knows how to build and fly a 747 aircraft? And you think about it. Someone must know, you think, right? Because you go to the airport, and you know, take your four-hour drive to the airport, and you look there and you see these aircraft, right? They manifestly fly. And mostly they stay in the air where they're supposed to. So someone must know. But nobody knows how to do it. If you had one person, take any one person and say, do you know how to do it? There's always something that they don't know. Particularly if you take it right down, you're the manufacturer of like special glass for the windows, or you know, design of navigation systems, electronics. There's no person knows this. So there really couldn't be the expert on 747 aircraft. The knowledge is distributed, which means that When you want to learn about 747 aircraft, the only thing you can do is to put yourself into this knowledge network and begin interacting. For what Siemens is describing, what I'm describing, one of the major and essential elements that needs to be in place is open access. And those of you who read my website, I talk about open access a lot. The reason why I talk about it a lot is because closed access, restricted databases, even registration forms before you can access something. Yesterday's speaker, he didn't have any slides. You know, I don't have any slides, right? That's because he didn't have any references. I put all of this stuff here. You click on that, you go directly to the resource. I followed the one website he gave us. He wants us to register before we sign in. That's broken, right? That's the network breaking down. If you have to cross a gate or a barrier or something like that every time you want to access new information, then you're not functioning easily and efficiently in the network. It quite literally is broken. If the human brain has little interruptions in the signals going from neuron to neuron, we call that person pathologically ill. And we send them to the hospital, and we give them disease names like Alzheimer's and things like that, because it is a fundamental breakdown of the neural network. The same thing is the case in the networks of knowledge. If you had to sign your name every time you wanted to access a piece of information on how to fly a 747 or how to build a 747, you'd never learn. You'd be sitting there typing your name and your email address every 5 minutes for the rest of your life. The network of learning requires a free flow of information. And the mechanisms to enable this free flow of information, I've put a few of them up here, Creative Commons, a way for you to indicate on your material that it can be freely shared and distributed in the network. Just curious, how many of you have heard of Creative Commons? A little more than half. The rest of you, go to that URL. And if you produce and put stuff on the internet and you'd like people to be able to read it and to use it themselves, and we'll come back to that, then you want to use Creative Commons. Budapest Open Access Initiative, a major initiative promoting the open distribution of academic papers. Right now we live in an environment where somebody is paid by the government to be a researcher, to write a paper, they write their paper, they submit it to the publisher, publisher assumes all copyright to it, and then they turn around and they sell it to us for $10,000 or whatever. Or doing a paper-by-paper basis, $35 for a three-page paper that was paid for by the government in the first place. It's loony. And there is a growing movement to enable open access to electronic, to academic materials, specifically electronically, because it's cheap. Every university in the Netherlands, for example, has signed on to an agreement. All research produced by university professors in the Netherlands will be made available for free in an open access environment. There's a trust, I forget the name of it, Hewison, Oyenson, something like that, trust in Britain. All research funded by that trust fund, it's hundreds of millions of pounds, has to be placed in open access. I'm pushing for it at NRC. Everything produced by researchers, paid for by the Canadian taxpayer, ought to be posted and freely accessible on the web. The flip side of that is public institutions have to stop paying for this stuff. If you're buying into closed proprietary content sources, then you're buying into something that is breaking the flow of information. There are other ways to pay for the production and distribution of knowledge and learning. Most of you, if not all of you, are living examples of the other way. Every time you produce something, it's not like you're working for free, but you know, it's not like you're getting 5 cents for every page that you produce either, is it? There are other ways to pay for this stuff. The trend, and I'll come back to this at the end of the talk, assuming I have time. I got gobs of time. Is toward what is sometimes being called the open society. And these are going to be the watchwords, not simply for government, although you're beginning to see it. Like all of you, I'm sure I've certainly enjoyed the high theater that has been government recently. Transparency, those of you who've been in the system for a while are probably seeing a push toward greater transparency. This will continue. Accountability, inside government I can certainly talk about, needing to be more accountable. Partnerships, organizations. I went to a session yesterday, Best of the West, and the main message that came out of that was that the e-learning organizations that have come up, Campus Saskatchewan, Campus Manitoba, Campus BC, mostly, I forget the names of the Alberta ones, I'm just kidding. Why does Alberta have two? Anyhow, partnerships, right? They're mostly partnerships with institutions, building collaborations, working together. Again, it's the same model, creating this network. I say network a lot. It's a really important underlying concept for all of this. Networks. E-learning 2.0 is fundamentally about networks. And it's fundamentally about networks, and it might be on a later slide, or I might have intended to put it here. See, you've all been on the web, right? Anyone not been on the web? I'm just checking. 10 years, I give a talk 10 years ago, most of the room hasn't been on the web. Just astonishing now, to give them. And you know what it's like to go on the web. You sit down in front of your computer, you start up your browser, hopefully Firefox, and you go to a website and you read. And then you go to another website and you read. And then you open up your email client, hopefully Thunderbird, and you read. And mostly, from 95 or so till now, the web has been one way. How many of you have websites? That's pretty good. It's still like about a quarter. It's dramatically greater percentage than your average audience. But mostly, the experience of the web for people has been reading, right? Web 2.0 is what is going back to Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the read-write web, the interactive web, the idea that what the web isn't just a bunch of passive web pages that sit there, that when you go to a web page, you interact with it, you engage with it, it becomes a conversation. One good example of this sort of thing is in the work being done recently on social networks. I've got a link there, Clay Shirky, second link there. Read that too, if you haven't read that. Talking about social networks and what are sometimes called power laws, and the important thing about that article is that it will tap you into a discipline known as social network analysis, or sometimes network analysis, which has its origins in a branch of mathematics called graph theory. And the idea here is to describe in a formal and precise way the properties of systems of networked and interactive components. And this is sufficiently well known now. There's been a lot of work done, people like Duncan J. Watts, for example. We have a good understanding of what the properties are. and we see things happen in these networks. We see things, for example, like the spontaneous creation of communities. We see things happen like the natural, not managed, but natural organization into topics or category clusters. We see formal or social networks form. We see the propagation of, well, sometimes it's called memes, sometimes it's called ideas, but we see ideas propagate through the network. And the same theory that underlies interacting websites and individuals on the internet, exactly the same theory mathematically, is that which underlies the growth of trees, the spread of rivers, communication among crickets in the Amazon, the spread of a disease. And consequently, knowing how these networks work, we're able to predict that if we set up our system, our internet, our knowledge network, in a certain way, we can reasonably predict that this will be the result. I try to capture, the third link there is to something I did earlier this year in Vancouver, try to capture some of that and talk about how we should shape the network in order to be able to more effectively distribute knowledge and information. The Web 2.0 as well is a technological layer. How many of you have heard of a thing called Ajax? And I don't mean the cleaner. One. Ajax is a set of JavaScripts, common JavaScripts, which means fairly common functions and routines, that allow a website designer to basically put the interaction in a website on the web page itself, so that it's managed by a JavaScript rather than being called back to a server every couple of seconds. If you go to Gmail, have you ever seen Gmail? If you've used Gmail, you're sitting there thinking, whoa, that's really fast. You compare Gmail to, say, even Outlook, like Gmail just zips right along. Gmail has all of its stuff, all of its interactive features actually sitting in the browser when you're on that web page. And there are messages that go back and forth to the server, but they're just little tiny messages. And you're not reloading all of the features of that web page anymore. Basically, when you go to Gmail, first time you go to Gmail, it's like you've practically downloaded an entire email application and put it in your browser cache. So the interactive web is not just a concept. It's also a set of technologies that ride along with that concept. The one person who knows Ajax is going, oh my God, no, you got it completely wrong. I'm glossing a little bit, and I'm going to admit that I'm glossing a little bit. But I'm trying to capture the essential idea. The interactivity, the functions that support the interactivity are delivered to you and live in your browser. Interactivity. You've all heard of web blogging, right? Those who haven't aren't going to admit it, because it's been all over the news recently, and even if you've seen the word, you haven't followed it, there's no way you're not. Anyhow, never mind. Sometimes I get off on little tangents like that. When you're doing a talk, you just have to know when to bail. The weblog, of course, is a mechanism that allows people to publish articles or posts, as they're called, and to display those posts in reverse chronological order. So each post is dated. They are displayed on your website most recent first, so that when a person goes to the website, they start reading at the top, and reading down until they hit something that they've already seen before, and then they're caught up. The main thing about blogging isn't the form, it isn't the content. People talk about, it's just, the journals of angst-ridden teenage girls, and maybe 50 million of them. It's not that. What has happened in blogging is that a set of applications have come along. I linked to a couple of them here. Blogger, LiveJournal, there's a bunch more. TypePad is another one. Radio UserLens is another one. WordPress, which really I should have linked to, is one. If you're picking... Well, never mind. WordPress is an open source blogging application that you can put on your own web server. But if you're very new to this, you don't have a blog, you're curious, go to Blogger. That's the place to go. And Blogger will step you through it. You don't need to study a manual to use Blogger. And this is the whole thing. It makes web publishing easily and virtually instantly accessible. Anyone can do it. Millions of people have, more than 10 million at this point. A third of this room. Can you raise your hands again, those of you who have blogs? Okay, not quite a third, about a bit less than a quarter. Still, a significant number of people. The idea here is that you, when you are a blogger, you're no longer a passive consumer of information on the web. Now you're contributing to it. And you're contributing to it in a meaningful, measurable way. It's not like the old days when you put up a web page and, you know, like Homer Simpson, right? You put the little visit counter on it, right? You look at it and there's nothing happening. Because blogs form what might be called a large network, and I'll talk about some of the mechanics of that in a couple seconds, blogs, even very new blogs, have a chance of being read, and they do feed in to an overall network of blogs. There's a lot of talk right now, I can never pronounce her name, Lilia Alfanova. Can anyone do better than that? No? She's a Russian blogger. I don't have the link here, I really should. Does work in blogging communities. Because, again, it's this conversation happening here. But it's a distributed conversation. I put something on my blog. Somebody else reads it. They react, but they don't send me an email. They put a comment in their blog and link back to me. So now we've got two things linked. And then a third person comes along, and they create some more content. They link to the first two things. And I create more content, link back to the third. And so you get this web, this densely packed web of interrelated posts. And these interrelated posts are what constitute the network that I was just describing a few minutes ago when I was talking about building 747s. If I was going to start a 747 plan from scratch, I'd have everybody involved in the plan start up a blog. And this would be navigation, this would be windshields, this would be wingtips, whatever. And then as these pieces interact, the links get built. The blog is the informal layer of communication that would occur over and above the more formal layer of technical description. These concepts lead us into a theory of learning that has begun to evolve in between when you first had me... Remember when you called me last October and now, all of this has happened in between that period of time. This diagram didn't exist then. This is the picture of where we're moving to. How's my time doing? 15, okay. You know how you all work with learning management systems, right? The learning management system is institution-based, right? Well, that future VLE that's sitting in the center there is not institution-based. That is the student's e-learning application. The blogger of e-learning. And what's happening here is that the student is tapping in through this network to various resources scattered around the internet. This diagram was created by Scott Wilson from CETUS in the UK. And he's linking to a bunch of things that are fairly common in the blog sphere. LiveJournal is one of those blogging applications. That's up in the upper left there. 43 Things is a social networking application. Flickr, which I'll mention in a moment, is like Blogger, is like social networking, but for photographs, and so on. And in your own mind, what you should be picturing is Nate, U of C, U of A, University of Saskatchewan, BCIT, SIAS, instead of those bubbles there, and whatever else. I once built a thing called Pegasus. In fact, they built it right in this city, right here in Edmonton. And you can find it online, Pegasus 2Gs, PEGGASUS.CA. Should still be there. And this was the concept that I was trying to instantiate. It's one of these things, but for geologists and geophysicists and engineers. It was done in collaboration with the University of Alberta, APIGA, the Association of whatever, I can never remember it, and a company here in Edmonton. And we put this together, and the idea was that if you're an engineer or a geologist, you log on to your future VLE, and then all of these resources related to engineering, geology, etc., training or certification or whatever you needed to do for your job would be available through this e-learning application. Now, Pegasus was a bit before its time, and one of the problems with Pegasus is none of the learning providers were prepared for something like this. They all wanted the learner to go to their site, register in their institute, go through admissions first, of course, right? Do all the work in their learning management system. In other words, each institution wanted to set it up so that it would break the network, so that they would be the sole source of learning for that particular student. And those of you who work in networks know this really well, right? Pegasus was intended to get past the sole source idea. And as it turned out, because, yeah, it was petroleum engineers, geologists, geophysicists, they have lots of tuition money. So mostly the institutions were willing to play ball, but they weren't willing to take that extra step and enable the technology to create this as a network. So they didn't mind the little parts, they just didn't want the connections to happen. You see the little writing there in the lines? In other places, they give me one of those laser pointers, and I go. But I've been known to abuse those too. So those little lines, each one of them, and some of them say FOF and ADAM and RSS and so on. Each one of those is a protocol, an XML protocol for the syndication of content information. And in order to make this network work, course functions, course information, course content needs to be expressed in one of these protocols. And that's the part that the institutions wouldn't do. I'm saying, give us an RSS feed of your current offerings for engineers. And they're going, what? Do I have a slide on RSS? Well, sort of. I'll come back to that in a second. I'm bouncing between two things here now. I'm bouncing between user-generated content and connectivity of that content. So we're back to user-generated content. We talked about blogs. Blogs are just the beginning. Right now, I'm recording this talk. You saw me set it up at the beginning of this talk. When we finish this talk, oh, I'm recording it using a program called Audacity. I might have the link there. No, I don't. Darn. I just didn't have enough room in these slides for links. A-U-D-A-C-I-T-Y. If you use Google, I'll do something like Audacity. Well, it should show up top link, actually, if you just type that in. I think it does. If not, you might do Audacity Audio. It's an audio recording program. It's open source. It's free. So I'm using Audacity. I'm recording this. I'll save it. Then I'll use another open source program called FileZilla. I'll upload it to my website, and then I'll include the link to that in an RSS feed. And you'll find that on my website at downs.ca/news/audio.htm. That's my podcast. And basically, when I do that, somebody can sign up or go to my website with any of the clients listed in iPodder. That's the top link there. And by pushing basically one button, be able to take the audio that I put on my website and automatically toss it onto their iPod or any of their other MP3 players, and then listen to it while they're jogging on the way to work. So if you're listening to this while you're jogging or walking on your way to work, hi, you're an example. It's interesting for me, is because I'm creating this, I'm talking to this group, but I'm also talking to the people who are listening to this recording. It's changed my talks completely. It's now I prepare for them. I'm just kidding. Flickr. Go to Flickr. Flickr is a place where if you take digital photographs, like the ones you saw being displayed before this talk, you can upload them and share them with your friends. Flickr is not just a place to store photographs. It also embodies many aspects of social networks. There have been a variety of social networks out there. Friendster, Orkut, Tribe, LinkedIn, a few others. They haven't taken off because all they do is connect people. That's like taking a bunch of people, putting them in a room, and then leaving. And people, you know what happens. We see it in elevators all the time. People sort of sit there. I'd say from experience, this makes for a really dull website. But if you take those people and you give them something to talk about, in this case, the images, and give them a way to share things, now you've got something going. And that's what Flickr has done. Flickr just sold, I forget who they sold themselves to. Well, it doesn't matter. Anyhow, they just made a whole pile of money selling the service. And now it's going to be embedded in something bigger. Wikipedia. How many of you have heard of Wikipedia? Great. Moving on. I don't need to talk about that anymore. The point here is that we are just entering into a period of creative explosion on the interweb. I love that name. And remember what I was talking about at the beginning of the talk about the traditional mediators being irrelevant? When everybody creates content, why do we need professional content creators? And if you think about this, how this applies to education, because we're all in the business of professionally creating, learning content. But we're in an era where we're moving into an era where everyone creates content. And we need to think about how that changes our role in this environment. They're all producing courses. What happens in 5 years when the students produce their own courses? What's your job then? We're all producing learning materials, tests, and so on. What happens when that gets taken over by the students? Everyone talks about certification and, you know, you got to go to university to get a degree or to get a certificate. What happens, and it will happen, when colleges and universities lose that monopoly? And then certification becomes a public commodity where anybody can do it. And it's not that they're guaranteed, but they exist in a public market space, establishing trust and reputation by the performance of their graduates rather than by an administrative signature. Now, that's not going to happen tomorrow. It is going to happen in our lifetime. Count on it. Maybe by the time you retire, maybe not. In my case, I'll probably be retired. But it is going to happen. What happens to the role of educational institutions when content production, learning activities, and certification are all being handled by the students? It's going to happen. Okay, I guess that was controversial. But I mean, it was controversial, like, you're skiing, eventually you're going to hit the bottom of the hill, right? You know, while you're skiing, yeah, no problem, right? You're going to hit something? What are you talking about? You know, but you know where the slope goes. Eventually, there's a bottom. And even though you can't really see the bottom when you're at the top of the hill skiing nicely, there's still a bottom, because if you just understand hills, that's how hills work. And that's how the internet and the trends that I've talked about, those are the hill. And we are the skier. How is that analogy? I've never used that before. And I try to use analogies. The mechanism behind this, if you go to my website, every once in a while you read, almost daily, you read stuff about RSS, which stands for really simple syndication, or ATOM, which is like RSS, except it's an alternative, because there is no like standards body organizing all of this. It's the consumers of the technology rewriting the technology, quite literally in this case. What these technologies do, all they are, is a way of representing content in XML. And all XML is a way of representing parts, discrete parts of content. So it's nothing more than a syntax for indicating this is a title, this is a link, this is a picture. That's XML in a nutshell. And unless you want to be a technologist, that's all you need to know about XML. It's just a formal representation of content. And the thing is, as a formal representation of content, it allows these sites to interact. It's like your brain, right? One neuron sends electrical signals, another neuron receives electrical signals. Wouldn't work if one neuron sent electrical signals and another neuron received shredded wheat. Wouldn't work, right? You got to receive the same thing that you sent. Otherwise, you don't have a connection. That's all XML is a way of making sure what we send is the same thing that what we receive. So we know what we're getting. And web content syndication does, and it's just a neat little diagram here, that was produced about 2 weeks ago, by the way, is it takes content from many different sources. I talked about 300 people or so in my field who are blogging. Actually, it's probably a lot more than that. Take the content from all of those individuals. You bring it together. And you go, and then you send it out. I use the slogan, aggregate, bring it together. Remix, take a bit here, a bit here, a bit here, put it all together. Repurpose, add a metaphor on top, localize it, feed it forward, send it to the next person in the link. That's the activity that teachers do. It's also the activity that students do. Teachers and students do the same thing. Just teachers, presumably, do it better. And so that they can model instead of broadcast. And the neat thing is, remember, I've forgotten his name again, Milron? Remember he was talking about selective attention, and you don't see what you're not looking for? I was sitting just over there somewhere. I was sitting there thinking, you know, I'll bet you a lot of people are wishing that their email was like that. Where you don't get email unless you want it. And a lot of people are thinking, well, even television, right? You know, you wish you got what you wanted in television instead of, I don't know, Three's Company and Gilligan's Island. Or what is it they do these days? Mako on a desert island or whatever. But the thing is, if you organize your network of connected individuals' websites and content in the network that I've just described, then it acquires the properties that we know exist in such networks. And one of those properties is this kind of selective filtering. you don't need to manage it or control it. It's not, it's like there's no little man in our head saying, pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that. It's the structure and organization of our neurons. As experience comes in over time, through processes that are well known and well documented and well understood, the neurons connect each other. If you're curious about the mechanics, do a Google search for Hebbian, H-E-B-B-I-A-N, associationism. Is a good first cut at this. And they set up your neural network in such a way that when you go out and experience it, the world, you see what's relevant to you, and your mind, quite literally, ignores the rest. Don't look up. How many circles are on that roof? Nobody knows. You all saw the roof when you came in. Or like from yesterday, how many of you saw the gorilla? The web works in the same way if it's structured appropriately, if the connections are put into place, and if information is allowed to flow freely between them. You need both things. The latest catchphrase being used to capture this is the e-portfolio. E-portfolio, that's just the VLE in the center of the circle. That's all I'm going to say about that. There's a lot of stuff happening now in the technological community. Some of it's good, some of it's less so. But the idea, remember I was talking about those little standards to connect all those connections and FOF and RSS and all of that. Well, collections of these standards connecting interrelated applications, this body of standards plus the applications that make this possible is known as a framework. And again, those of you who are know about frameworks are going, no, don't say it like that. But again, it's a bit of a gloss. But basically, a framework is the architecture that allows a distributed set of work of resources to work together using common standards. This one up here is by JISC. It's a British group, and I've got some links to some others. OKI. And if you follow Scott Leslie's resource, which he released yesterday, Bill, you'll find links and a lot of discussion of these as well. Where is this going? Now, you've heard lots of stuff about games, right? Games and learning. Mark Prensky, Seymour Papert, James Paul, Paul G., Clark Aldrich, they're some of the important. Now, right now, you think of games, you think like Tomb Raider or what's that one? Oh, I forget what it's called. The one everyone hates where you drive around hitting people. Think of games rather along the lines of being like one of these networks that I've just talked about. How many of you, I'm assuming most of you have heard of SimCity, right? Now, SimCity is a simulated city. You go in there, you're the city manager. You raise taxes, you lower taxes, whatever. Imagine SimCity, but the data points for SimCity all come from real sources. SimCity isn't just an application that sits on your machine, but it actually connects to the real world. And imagine SimCity where you don't have godlike powers of city managers, but there's another 100 people in the game playing with you, and they have their own ideas about how the city is being run. That's learning of the future. And I'm anticipating a slide or so here, but and why can't we actually run a city that way? I'll come back to that. Mobile learning. There was a talk by the HP guy. I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name.
Garcia,
because I argued with him. Nobody was in the room, but I was arguing with him. One of the things that, well, he was in the room. He's talking about PDA, right? He had one, right? He works for HP, right? So he had a Dell. No, I'm kidding. And part of what he's saying is right. You have one device, right? It's your phone, it's your GPS, it's your camera, it's your audio recorder, it's your doorstop, and it'll resuscitate you if you have a heart attack. But that's only part of mobile learning. If we get to the concept of ubiquitous computing, right? We're talking about putting everything in one real mobile device. But really, where we're headed is computing is simply in the environment. And to me, I think it's kind of silly to have to carry something. Even this, I leave this everywhere because it's big, it's bulky. I mean, I want something like a Star Trek badge. And the thing is, the Star Trek badge is not like an entire computer sitting in a little badge. The Star Trek badge just taps into the computing power that happens to be around. Right? Right now, electricity, if you have a laptop, you know what I mean, you're always looking around for the plugs. Well, your Star Trek badge would do that for you. And it'd be tapping into bandwidth. And be tapping into computer applications, like those Ajax frameworks, only, for Star Trek badges. And it'll make use of whatever computer resources that are there. The idea here is that computing is part of our environment, like light is, or the example that I like to use, writing. Think about it. There was once a day, and it wasn't that long ago, when you actually had to look around and search for writing. People had reading rooms, special rooms in their houses where they would go to read. Now, writing is everywhere. There's writing here. This is not a coffee table. See what they've done? They've put some writing right here because they know I'm going to put my coffee cup there. That is usability. That's annoying usability. It's usability. Writing. There's some writing here so that Bill didn't need to remember anything about me. writing everywhere we want. Imagine right now, every place you see writing, imagine a full-fledged computer application sitting there that your little Star Trek badge can tap into. You can get video displays from it, audio displays from it. It can teach you things. This is where you get your learning from. Talking about institutions. Why on earth would anybody go to a special building and a classroom to learn when the learning can be available wherever they happen to be? And all of this stuff that I talk about, because if you look at that, there's our network diagram again. And those technologies that I talked about, those sorts of technologies, the 2030 versions of them, will be what powers this, what makes this network of ubiquitous computing able to teach us wherever we happen to be. Jay Cross takes the same concept, applies it to the workplace. You're on the job, you need to learn something, whatever you're working on, whatever that happens to be, it teaches you. Every once in a while, people play that scene from The Matrix, right? Do you know how to fly a helicopter? Not yet. Okay, let's go. Except in the workplace. Think of it, using PowerPoint. I use PowerPoint. I'm terrible at PowerPoint. And I'd like to learn how to use PowerPoint. When I use PowerPoint, the only thing available to me is Microsoft Help, which I consider fundamentally dysfunctional. What I want is something that will teach me how to use PowerPoint as I use PowerPoint. What I want is something that will teach me how to use this projector system as I use the projector system. Actually, this was not bad. It was pretty good. I was impressed. Substantially more advanced than I've seen of these sorts of systems in the future. Computer game designers know that if you force your gamers to read a manual before they play the game, they will not play the game. Or they will play the game without reading the manual and they will hate the game. The game teaches you as it goes along. This is very well understood by game designers, technology designers in general. As technology improves, the technology more and more is teaching you how to use it. And why can't tractors be like that? Well, I think they can. There's lots of places in a tractor to put dozens and dozens of computers. take this further. This is going to happen, I think, within our lifetimes, where the whole idea of living, the whole idea of learning as being something separate from the rest of our lives, fades into the background. Right now, we're in an environment where people take, between 2 and 8 or 10, I took 10 years of my life and devoted it to learning. You won't be able to do that in the future. People think this is a ridiculous waste of time. Just start doing stuff and learn as you're doing stuff. From the point of view of educational providers, which is what all of you are, I was talking about what is the role of the institution. And you always think about, classes and degrees and things like that. I was talking about what the students are going to be doing, all of that. That doesn't mean your role goes away, but it means that what you should be thinking now is, how do I get education out of the classroom, out of the school, and into the lives of people? Bill took me on a little tour two days ago, and showed me the welding trailers that Nate has. They're welding trailers, right? And basically, they're welding shops on wheels, right? And it looked at the tractor trailers. They didn't look like much, but you can imagine that they sort of unfold, and wherever they are, fully equipped welding shop. That's cool. And you can go anywhere with these things and teach people how to weld. And you start to go, that's wonderful. And then the kicker, how do you pay for this? Because let's think about it. You've got an 18-wheeler going to, Fort McKay, and you're going to do welding, and you're not going to drive all the way up there for a 3-hour class, because you have to charge like $500 for the 3-hour class. So I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about this in this frame, right? And now this is only half the germ of an idea, but why would you take an entire welding lab to a remote northern community and do nothing with it but teach? And when you ask the question that way, you realize the answer is, I would be insane to do that. Why would I do only teaching? Because teaching is just one of the things that happens in these communities. I'd be sitting there saying, well, here you have a remote northern community. And you ask yourself, do you think they could use a fully equipped welding shop for anything? And of course, yeah. Why not redo all the plumbing in the community center? Why not do a work of those ugly metal sculptures and give the town other people like them. Why not take your kids to the welding shop for a day? And you get all the rugrats that are running around, usually they're destroying things or whatever. Get them in and have them destroy some metal productively. You know what I mean? Take the learning beyond the learning. You got a fully equipped welding truck, and all you think of to do with it is to teach people how to weld. It's too narrow a view. Learning has to go well beyond the school, the classroom, and into people's lives. And the idea here is to be disruptive. I was in Mississauga. I was amazed by Mississauga. You wouldn't think, right? Yeah. Mississauga is a suburb city, right? I was in a place called the Living Arts Center. It's a center basically designed to allow people to create. And I imagine there are other such things around. There weren't in Moncton, so I'll complain about that. But the idea here is that creation, learning, living, working, hobbies, all of these merge into a single dynamic flow of activity. We don't distinguish between learning and working and whatever anymore. That's the direction in which we're headed. And that, according to the demographers, including the ones I just heard in North Bay recently, that is the attitude that the younger generation is taking already. Vacation? Well, what's vacation? I talked to NRC, I said, vacation, great, I can get some work done. Where does this go? I tacked on this slide this morning because I had an argument with the HP guy. Garcia, I really wish I could remember people's names. If you're in the audience, I'm sorry. I don't see you either, but that's just my eyesight. Talking about the system, so you have your computer, it's your PDA or whatever, and when you're taking a test, he said, the institution computer could lock down your computer and make sure that all you do is take your test. No instant messaging, no web browsing, no nothing. And I was sitting in the back of the room taking notes, and I sort of went, what? There's no way in the world I want something like that. There's no way I want an institutional service taking control of my computer and telling me what I can or cannot do with it. My computer is my connection to the world. It's like a bunch of thugs coming out and gagging me, except electronically. I wouldn't put up with it. And it raises some of the issues that are going to face us. In the news just last week, Intel coming out with new computer processors that have digital rights management built right into the chips themselves. What that means is that content providers like Disney and Microsoft can lock down your computer and allow your computer to view only authorized content. That's the purpose of these things. Now, the ostensive, I was arguing with Garcia about this, well, if you don't have something like that, you get child pornography. Well, yeah, but if you have paper, you get child pornography too, but you don't lock up all the paper. I mean, the thing is, we're at this divide right now. Who controls the technology? Who controls the information? And this remains an open question. I mean, generations come, generations go. Trends come, trends go. The trend is toward, as I said, an open society. But the counter trend, which is in full flight right now, is toward a closed society, where what we view is the authorized, official, Disneyfied version of the truth, or of reality, whatever current politics says reality is. And so, as you make your decisions of what content to use and to buy, what kind of software applications to use, what kind of computer to buy when you go to the store, are you going to buy one of these DRM lockdown chips? You need to ask yourself, what are the fundamental values of the internet for me? And my big problem is, this is the problem when you're writing a paper the day before you're giving it. I came up with two, I was going to call them two dogmas of cyberspace. And the two dogmas are ownership of the platform. You and only you control your platform. And the other dogma is ownership of the data. If you produce data, you own it. And I include in this data that you produce by walking around and living in the world. You know, data about you. And I realize, you know, I'm walking back to the hotel and I haven't had enough sleep. And I'm sitting there and I'm coming up with these things. I've just argued with Garcia and it's all going. I realize these two dogmas are mutually contradictory. They can't both be true. So I'm stuck with that. And I haven't resolved that in time for this talk. But it seems to me that something like that is the case. I'm just going to end on this note. We talk about democracy, and you've probably heard talk about digital democracy, and digital democracy as it has been instantiated thus far. You have government services on one side, leave that aside. You have things like online discussion forums and online voting. And that's the old model of democracy. That's where we are consumers of government. And then there is a producer of government up there, Parliament Hill, doing whatever it does to produce government. And what we want, I think, is a mechanism that enables us to engage with society in the same way that we engage with anything else on the internet, where we disintermediate how our society is governed, and we do it for ourselves. I talked about that Sim City game. I've talked about things like a budget simulator. Why can we not create our own federal budget, each and every one of us logging into the budget simulator and creating the budget as we think it should be? Why wouldn't that work? And if you don't have the time or you don't have the interest, don't do it. Nobody has to do this stuff. I think that's the last slide. But I'm going to leave it from there. I know there are some questions, but that's life in the digital world where it's not all nice, neatly tied. As Douglas Rushkoff said it best, and he said it a long time ago, it's like a wave, all right? It's like, you know, we think of knowledge and information as static or things like that. It's static and firm and fixed, and we have repositories where we hold our content. It's not like that. It's like a wave. It's like this dynamic flow where the information comes, the changes come, and we dip and weave with it. And right now I'm kind of there. And I don't know where there is, but I'll just ride the wave and see how it goes. That's the talk. It was very different from the other version of the talk of the same name. And I hope I'm not too badly over time. So thank you very much for taking time out of your day. My website, downs.ca.
Stephen, you've talked about time quite a bit, and this is a gift that's just past time.
Woo-hoo,
some things are just in time. But this, we would have been better to give you an hour ago, so you would have been able to look at the time better.
Oh, it's a clock.
You are close.
I'm close. It's
actually, it's a battery. You'll have to go and find
it's
one.
It's a battery, yeah. I'm just going to...
We are probably with enough time for one or two questions, but the sessions will start at 15:45, so quickly, please.
Two questions, but the second one is a little
later. Oh, right. I'm sorry, I completely forgot about it. Yeah, it's interesting. I got an email yesterday. I could actually even bring it up, but I won't because then you'd see all my other emails, and I want to keep those all secret. That's my cat's webpage. That's the interspecies part. That's my former cat. She's not with us anymore. I miss her. Got a an email from someone in Brazil, and had some questions in that. The bottom of the email, it says, keep doing this. Keep doing this because we in the developing world need it. And, you know, how do I get paid for? It costs each and every one of you approximately, I forget what it is, 3 cents? I figured it out once. 3 cents to pay for me. I'm pretty cheap. And that's how you pay for these things. You pay for these things at source. We're getting political here, but I'll do it for just a second. In my view, we have a sufficiently rich society, and indeed, a sufficiently rich world, that we can guarantee every person the necessities of life. Food, housing, clothing, and using internet technologies, access to information and learning. We can easily do it. In the debates preceding free trade, remember we had free trade election and all of that, there was a commission called the McDonald Commission. They recommended free trade and guaranteed income. If we had that, then we have this massive upsurge of creativity. It doesn't cost a lot, as it turns out, to keep a person alive. It costs a lot less than a lot of the money that we spend on other things. So I think that there is enough wealth in society to allow society to pay for a certain subset of probably self-selected creative people to do the writing. You ask, how do you pay for these things? How do you pay for Wikipedia? Nobody got paid a dime for Wikipedia. And yet, we have an encyclopedia that rivals and is probably better than Britannica. It's just people had just enough leisure time to put into something like this. I think if we put the tools into people's hands, that what we need will get created by itself. Who got paid for Firefox? Firefox was a volunteer project. Well, now the people have been hired off by Google or whatever, but it was a volunteer project. Who got paid for creating the Apache web server? When they built it, it was an open source project. That's what people do. People create things. Given the time, the opportunity, the motivation, and the tools, people will create spontaneously. So the idea here should be not how do we pay people to create things. Nobody can afford to do that. It's how do we give people the time they need to do it themselves. It's not how do we get people to do things. It's rather how do we empower people to do things. So, you know, when I entered the workforce, like, a century ago, it was a 40-hour work week. Now, productivity, you know, computers, robots, and all of that, and what is a 40-hour work week? And, you know, I think we should be pushing toward making sure people have the opportunity to create. Google gives every employee 30% of the time to do, well, whatever. All right? Why don't your colleges? So I think that's the approach that we have to take here. It's not a question of buying and paying for this. Nobody can afford that. It's a question of creating the conditions under which we as a society can do it for ourselves. It's like teaching. People talk about providing an education, and governments spend millions, hundreds of millions. How much is this building worth?
A few,
right? We're talking about providing an education for people. There are 6 billion people on the planet. How are we going to provide an education like this for all of them? We do not have enough money in the world. Sir John Daniel, that line, all the time. We must change our attitude to this and take the approach that we are not providing a learning. We are making it possible, putting the conditions in place, the time, the resources, so that they can do it for themselves. It's the only way to do it.
Perhaps if there's other questions, we could take them offline at the front. Other sessions, you're welcome to leave to attend them. They will start on the quarter after the hour, 10:15, 11:15, 12:15. See you at lunch for my Latin summary. Please, with questions, do come down front, though. I don't want to discourage the questions at all.
And the URL, downs.ca/me/puds.htm. That was by request.
Good job, Steve.
Thank you.
I thought he was going to knock your copy off for you.
No, I just got to...
I had batteries here. I was just, but I didn't want to drop. Are you running out of batteries?
Oh, for this recording.
Yeah.
No, I've got...